Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray. And yeah, this is our last weekly show for a couple of weeks. We're taking some time off over here at Risky Biz HQ, but next week I will publish a soapbox episode that I recorded with Okta's head of technology strategy, Sammy Lane. And the week after that, I'll be publishing my interview with former Australian Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull. But of course, this week we will be talking through all the week's security news with Adam Boileau. That is coming up in just a moment, and then it will be time for this week's sponsor interview. This week's show is brought to you by Senatas, and we've got two sponsor guests for you this week. Senatas CTO Julian Fay will be joining us, as will Peter Farrelly of AU Cloud. Senatas uses AU Cloud as a partner for its SureDrop file sharing service here in Australia. And Pete is joining us this week to talk through the new cloud assessment and authorization framework published by the ACSC. Pete is, of course, the CISO from AU Cloud. And basically, if you work in Australian government IT and security, then that interview is relevant to your interests. We can safely say that. But before we get into all of that, of course, it is time for a check of the week's security news with Adam Boileau. We're going to begin with a bit of a minor tragedy in media, which is the team at Reuters, the security team at Reuters, were onto an absolutely cracking story that they had to hurry up and publish because they caught wind that Microsoft were about to ruin their party time. But yeah, they had a fantastic exclusive here about Russian efforts to target the Biden campaign.
Yes, Reuters are reporting attacks against a supplier to the Biden campaign, this company called SKDK Knickerbocker, who provides services for them. They appear to be based in Microsoft's cloud and, you know, are coming under attack from the GRU. Fancy bear crew going up against, you know, people involved in the political world. The Reuters reporting is focused on this particular organization, but Microsoft's, you know, level of visibility across their cloud infrastructure does seem to suggest that actually it's a much wider, you know, campaign going on for some time, you know, against a number of organizations across the political spectrum in the US.
Yeah, I mean, Microsoft really did release a fair bit of information. It looks like, yeah, 200 organizations targeted by GRU. They also detected a Chinese state-backed group, APT31, basically trying to validate email addresses and profile targets, sort of doing recon work, and they squashed a bunch of domains being used by the Iranians. It's interesting the contrast between now and 2016, right, where this stuff is absolutely being taken seriously. I've heard some people say, oh, well, this is evidence that Russia is trying to interfere in the election. It's not. I mean, that could be what they're trying to do, but we don't really know what they're up to. For all we know, they're just gathering intelligence.
Yeah, and the reports that we're seeing, you know, Microsoft's information, you know, describes a whole bunch of, you know, attempting to gain access. And we don't know, you know, what access was gained as a result of these attempts and then what it was used for. Like, those bits are kind of obscure to us. But, I mean, the sort of things that Microsoft's reporting are, you know, exactly what you would expect, right? Password brute forcing, password, you know, kind of reuse, you know, credential stuffing type things, you know, phishing, all the usual sorts of techniques that, as you say, in 2016, you know, worked very effectively. And now in 2020, you know, late 2019, you know, we are much better equipped, and Microsoft's much better equipped to be able to spot those things. And, you know, this is one of the advantages of people moving a lot of their stuff into the cloud, is we do get this kind of central visibility in a way that, you know, we just weren't getting when everyone was using, you know, Yahoo here and, you know, Hotmail there. You know, now there's a much more, you know, concentrated set of intelligence available to Microsoft, and more of an understanding of why it's important to talk about it.
The Microsoft Post goes through all of the attempts here and how, you know, how frequently they were doing brute force attempts against various accounts and whatever. And they said they were using a pool of approximately 1,100 IPs, the majority associated with the Tor anonymizing service, which I interpret that to mean that they mean Tor exit nodes, right? And of course, if you're seeing, like, you know, hundreds of thousands of failed login attempts from Tor exit nodes, you would think maybe that's how they caught this.
Yeah, that's a little bit of a giveaway. And I, you know, obviously being able to, you know what the pool of exit nodes are and be able to correlate that with your logs, it's a pretty strong indicator. And it's just kind of funny, I guess, in a way, because, you know, illustrating sort of the very dual use nature of Tor.
Yeah, and Microsoft's advice here is a little bit confusing because they're like, oh, here's a list of 530 net blocks that are associated with this activity. And I'm like, do you mean Tor? Or like, is this the other ones that weren't part? Like, it's just a little
Because we already knew about Tor. Like, yeah, most people knew
there's
about
like, there's other weird language in their release about how, you know, they're separating brute forcing from password spraying. And you can tell, like, the fact that they've made a distinction between those things is the result of a really intense nerd fight between various people there. Like, that's... That'd be my guess. But, you know, it's good that this stuff is being turned up, right?
Yeah, absolutely, Ike. It's good it's being spotted and it's being communicated. And also, I mean, the defensive options for people, like things like enable multi-factor authentication and monitor failed logins, like those are things that, you know, in 2016 were actually difficult for people. And now, you know, modular Microsoft's licensing for Azure, you know, are much more straightforward for people to do, which, you know, is, I guess, an improvement.
Yes, it is. Now, we've got a couple of beautiful stories that bookend each other just perfectly coming up now. CrowdStrike has released a, you know, it's a marketing report, let's be honest, but it's, you know, they got some interesting data from their like Falcon software. CrowdStrike sits on a bunch of logs, right? So it makes sense for them to pump out the odd report. They're seeing a trend in attacks, you know, more attacks against telcos, you know, nation state attacks against telcos. And we, you know, resulting in the headline here from Shannon Vavra at CyberScoop of Chinese hacking groups are bullying telecoms as 2020 goes on, CrowdStrike says.
Well, I mean, you know, telecoms are where lots of good stuff is, so it does kind of make sense. But yeah, the CrowdStrike reports are, you know, yes, they're marketing, but they are really interesting because of the level of visibility that they have. And, you know, it is good for individual sectors, you know, like the telco world, to be reminded that they are a target periodically. You know, somehow they manage to forget, I don't know. But yeah, also, you know, it's just good stuff about tradecraft and what tools are in use. And it's kind of one of the things that is funny about it is, you know, you read the list of, you know, common tools that are being used, you know, post-intrusion in the environments that CrowdStrike are looking at. And, of course, it's all off-the-shelf, open-source hacker tooling, you know, that pen testers use in environments. And pen testers are meant to be simulating adversaries, but the adversaries are using the pen test tools, you know, the Cobalt Strike and Mimikatz and stuff like that. So it's just kind of, you know, sort of a funny, you know, dog-eat-dog.
It's a bit of a life imitating art moment.
Yes, yeah.
But, you know, there's all the people who QQ a lot about, you know, open-source security tooling being used in this way. And it's like, I don't know, man, I don't think you really achieve much by... pulling it off the shelves, but that's a whole argument that we don't even want to get into.
Oh, yeah, we don't need to go down that one.
Oh, God. But look, as I introduced this, I said, like, you know, there's two stories here that bookend each other perfectly, right? The next one is from Catalin Kimpanu over at ZDNet and looks at some research by ESET. Tell us about this one, because this is so much more interesting than it at first appears.
Yes. So ESET were looking into some malware that they found, you know, the Linux-specific malware that appears to only target two versions of a particular Chinese company's like Linux voice switching software that you'd use in the middle of a soft phone network. And it steals specifically the call data records, right? It doesn't provide remote access. It doesn't, you know, crack passwords. It doesn't deny of service things. All it does is steal CDR records out of a very particular model of phone switch.
Yes. Which, made by a company called LinkNet. And if you click through to their customer page, you know, they've got customers like China Telecom, Huawei, ZTE, China Unicom, et cetera, right? So, I mean, I think it's hilarious that we got this headline, which is like, you know, CrowdStrike says American telcos are being bullied. And then very quietly, ESET drops a report about this, you know, CDR snarfing malware, which smells pretty Western SIGINT to me. I mean, is that your gut feeling there?
Well, I mean, you know, SIGINT agencies sure do love call records. Like, that's their bread and butter. And the fact that there's a whole bunch of Chinese, you know, CDR records going somewhere. Yeah, I mean.
This is NSA or ASD bullying Chinese telcos.
it might be GCHQ. Don't want to leave them out. Could be the Canadians. Who knows?
You never know. Could be those Swedes, you know. They punch above their weight, we hear, according to, you know, what is it, the cyber power indices. What else have we got here? Ah, now this is one, man. The CISA and FBI have put out a bulletin saying, for the love of God, please patch your stuff. They're pointing out that the Chinese Ministry of State Security is using just dumb bugs in stuff like Pulse Secure and F5, you know, stuff that you can patch and have been able to patch for quite some time. This is another one. Shannon Vavra wrote this one up for CyberScoop, wrote up the announcement. I had a bit of a chat to her and she seems to think that releases like this are a bit of a sign of exasperation conversation among security officials when, you know, clearly there is a way to at least make it harder. Here's what she said.
Some of these patches have been out for months, and they've been widely circulated, at least by US government agencies, with knowledge of what nation-state hackers are doing. And we're talking about hackers linked with China's Civilian Intelligence and Counterintelligence Service. It's basically conceding the fight to well-resourced hackers before the fight has even begun. At least give them some more barriers to overcome by patching before you just let them in this back door. We really need people to pay attention to this stuff, and that's the main takeaway that I'm gathering from this DHS and FBI release on the Ministry of State Security this week.
I mean, if you read between the lines, it sounds like Shannon's surprised they didn't sign the thing with facepalm emojis, basically. <You know? laughs>
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, you know, you wouldn't think that they would need to put out a, you know, please, for love of God, patch your
Yeah, but I mean, specifically, like, patch your border device that's open to the whole world. That, like, I mean, that's the thing. I admit to being a little bit surprised that people were slow to patch their Citrix and their, you know, and their PulseSecure stuff. I mean, that's the stuff at the edge of your network. That's the stuff that the entire internet can get to. What are you doing?
Well, exactly right. But we, you know, we have kind of forgotten about those edge controls for some reason, right? There was so much focus on other parts of the network. And yeah, they do get kind of forgotten and bit rotten. You know, people don't think about them as being the critical security controls that they are. And clearly that's a lesson they're being, you know, forced to learn.
Yeah. Oh, and just to preview something, apparently sometime tomorrow, the DOJ in the US is going to make an announcement about an arrest of someone who's apparently involved in, you know, Chinese government hacking activity. We don't really have any more details than that just yet, but that one, we'll be talking about that soon. Now, we've got another news article here looking at some work out of Recorded Future. We saw a bunch of reporting back in July about Chinese crews targeting the Vatican. I don't think we even spoke about it at the time because there was just so much going on back then. But this story is interesting because apparently, like, after all of that coverage, when everyone was like, oh my God, the Chinese are hacking the Vatican, they just didn't slow down. They didn't care, which is kind of interesting, isn't it? Just how brazen they are.
Yeah, because I mean, there is this kind of general expectation that when you call out an adversary, you know, say, hey, we see you in this environment, that they're probably going to take a step back because they care about their OPSEC or they care about being attributed to. And maybe that's a Western, you know, kind of bias there where we, you know, our agencies don't like being snapped and the Chinese just don't care. And in this particular case, the story goes that, you know, they were interested in some negotiations happening between the Vatican and the Chinese government about the, you know, the way the Catholic Church was going to operate in China. These intrusions happened before that so that they establish, you know, some intel about what the Vatican was going to say. Once those negotiations were done, the activity just stopped, like completely just didn't care about, you know, the response or the, you know, the discussion of their activity that had been publicized before. So this kind of shows how, you know, day-to-day and operational this stuff is.
Yeah. Indeed. Now, there's been some movement on the TikTok story. And so, look, the first bit of movement was reports that Microsoft was not going to buy TikTok. And then there were reports saying Oracle was going to take over TikTok US because of this whole, you know, Trump thing.
Poor Sherrod's going to
be so sad. That's right. Sherrod will be sad. So, yeah, there was this whole thing, oh, like, oh, no, okay, Oracle's going to take it over. And now it's come out that apparently Oracle is going to take equity, a minority share in TikTok, and act as TikTok's US technology partner. And they're going to submit this proposal to CFIUS, which is the Council for, like, Foreign Investment in the United States, and try to get them to sign off on it. And Trump seems to be saying positive things about it because, you know, Larry Ellison's a great bloke. But I don't actually understand what this achieves in terms of it being a security outcome, given that a majority Chinese-owned company operating in the United States with presumably some Chinese staff, you know, you're sort of back to square one. I mean, I don't get this, do you?
It doesn't make any sense. I mean, whoever thought of the, I mean, even if we disregard all the commercial aspects, right, the idea that by adding more Oracle, you will make a better security outcome, you know, that doesn't hold true.
It hasn't really worked in the past, has it?
It's never held true in the past. And yeah, like it doesn't make any sense. But none of this makes any sense anymore. I don't understand. But I don't know. It just looks like a scam, you know?
But, I mean, I don't know what the scam would be achieving aside from maybe getting Larry Ellison a discount on some TikTok stock. Like, but that can't be this. I just think it's more like the ADHD phenomenon coming out of the White House, you know? Like the whole thing's take your Ritalin, man. Take your Ritalin.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't make any sense. Like, I don't understand. Maybe some sense will prevail in the Cepheus, and they'll look at it and go, this is dumb, what are you doing? I mean, maybe.
I don't really know how much control the White House has over that process or the people appointed. And anyway, we're having a holiday, thank God. Mm-hmm. When we come back, the dust should have settled on this one, and we can actually have it. You know, there'll be hot takes to choose from when we get back, and we can talk about. Now, Huawei is taking its Harmony OS. This is an operating system that it was originally intended for things like smartwatches that it announced last year. Now it's going to launch Harmony OS as a smartphone operating system. I think this is interesting. We actually had a discussion about this a few weeks back, and I said, look, I think it's a matter of time before one of these Chinese tech companies launches its own OS. Now, someone came back at me on that saying, what use would a Huawei OS be when you can't run all these American apps on it? And I'm thinking that's a feature as far as the Chinese are concerned, not a bug, because then they get to own that ecosystem, right? And then imagine too, China is the largest smartphone market in the world, and they're pushing into emerging markets. They'll have a cost advantage. I mean, everyone in Africa and everyone in Southeast Asia might wind up on one of these devices, and you know, it'll be the US that winds up on the outside looking in. I mean, that's going to take time, and it might not be Huawei that does this, but I think people are being a bit too dismissive of this, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, I think people underestimate quite how big China is, right? And there's the US is so used to being the center of the world, you know, culturally and economically and technically, that they do forget that China is huge and has a very, very, you know, developed, you know, market that can build, you know, applications, build OSs, build technology.
Well, I think the thing is, China has always been full to the brim with very smart people, but over the last decade, they've got very organized, right? And this is not going to be that hard for them.
No, it's not, right? And they've got all the pieces that they need, and they've got a market to do it in, kind of quite a captive market in some senses. But yeah, they're not going to mess around, right? I mean, once they decide they're going to do it, they're going to do it. And, you know, the ecosystem will follow. They've got so much leverage. I think there's going to be a bunch of people for whom this is a really interesting opportunity. And I'm thinking, like, all of the Western intelligence agencies are going to be looking, going, fresh OS, fresh bugs, good times.
Well, no VEP either, right? Like, no vulnerabilities equities process for a Chinese OS, which is time,
there's
right?
There's going to be some positive outcomes for them. But yeah, in terms of what it means for, you know, interoperability and communication, you know, do we really want to end up in a world where we've got, you know, half the planet running, you know, an incompatible operating system from the other half, and then the reduced ability to kind of communicate and, you know, share experiences and, you know, have a peaceful world? That from that point of view, it doesn't feel great.
Balkanization, ain't it great? Mm-hmm. You know, and that's the thing, right? We're actually starting to see this pretty clearly heading somewhere that is not great, right? Which is maybe why initially some people might have felt good to see the United States pushing back on things like TikTok. But, you know, if you do it the dumb way, it doesn't necessarily get you to a better place, right? I think that's what you're trying to say.
Yeah. It does look like we're doing it the dumb way. That's the 2020 way.
Now, we got a really weird story here. You know, we just mentioned that the DOJ is going to announce some big deal charges against, like, you know, I'm guessing MSS-linked hackers, right? Okay. Now we got this other indictment that just landed, which is charging a 19-year-old Iranian fella with defacing some websites and another kid who's based in the Palestinian territories. There's this kid, Behzad Mohammadzadeh from Iran, and another guy, Marwan Abuzroor, who's based in Palestine. And I'm just thinking, this is just a really weird use of DOJ resources. Kevin Collier of NBC has actually been speaking to this kid in Iran since January, and he was happy to share his thoughts about this indictment with us. Have a listen to this.
So I've talked to Behzad several times this year. Most of it was in January after the U.S. assassinated Soleimani. To me, what was interesting at the time is that the U.S. was freaking out about a potential major retaliatory cyber attack from Iran, but all we saw was people like him who were defacing sites, and this is literally what I found on Zone H, an abandoned Mormon dental mission site and a company that turns steel pipes into feeding troughs for farm animals. As best I could tell, he really was just this definition of a script kiddie activist. I think you can read into these charges that they're yet another illustration of the U.S. having really harsh penalties for intrusions that don't cause major harm. But what I found most interesting here is that they happened at all, because usually hacking charges that are for citizens of a country that is not going to extradite to the U.S. are usually reserved for hardened alleged criminals or for officers of an intelligence service that the U.S. thinks crossed a red line. But this guy, by all appearances, is none of that. He really seems to be a script kiddie. And, you know, the charges don't make any indication that he's working for, you know, IRGC or something. So I checked in with him today. I should clarify that by talking to him, I mean that I chatted with the Telegram account that was left on all his defacements, which is consistent with the name in the DOJ charges. And he said that he had no idea that he'd been charged before I told him, and that he recently had gotten tired of defacement and a few months ago had just moved on to web design. Take that for what you will. He literally asked, and I quote, "Is the warning important or no?" And when it seemed to sink in what it meant, he said, quote, "I will not have a problem if I do not leave the country, but I would like to join Microsoft in the future," frowny face emoji. So now Sean at CyberScoop has reported that more DOJ charges against Iranians are imminent this week, I think. But it still seems to really underscore the point I really went for in my first story back in January, which is that this is the paltry activity that was coming out of Iran as retaliation for Soleimani, even though, you know, the U.S. was kind of freaked out about wiper attacks. And yet DOJ still brought charges here.
So Kevin Collier there talking about his mate in Iran. I mean, how good is that? Like, I couldn't believe it when he sent me that, because I didn't realize he spoke to him today, you know, and he sent me that that audio. I was just like, this is amazing. How good is that?
Microsoft should totally give that kid a job. Like, he's clearly going places. So, yeah. Oh, dear. I don't know. It's just, it really does highlight, you know, because back in the old days, like in the 90s, when, you know, the US government was so freaked out by computer hacking because they didn't understand it, and there was all sorts of crazy overreactions, and, you know, ended up with stupid laws. Ancient times for anyone, you know, that isn't, you know, is younger than us, which is, I guess, most of the listeners these days. Anyway, you know, there was all this kind of weird overreaction, and, you know, things are much more sane now because people have a better understanding of what it actually means to do the cyber. But this, right? I mean, you know, straight up Zone H defacement kids getting, you know, charges from the US into Iran. It's just, you know, it does feel a little bit out of proportion with what the actual cybers look like.
I mean, he could
face
10 years in prison, right? Like, for defacing a abandoned Mormon dental mission and a company that, like, takes recycled steel and turns it into feeding troughs for animals. Like, I don't know.
Oh, dear, poor guy. I mean, I mean, obviously he probably shouldn't deface things.
No, of course not. But I mean, it's like, you know, it should be a slap on the wrist for this sort of thing, I think. I mean, it's not like Marcus Hutchins, who deserved to have a bit of trouble because he was writing banking malware, you know?
This is like,
I don't know. I think too, if you've been around for a while in this sort of stuff, like, yeah, defacement kids, like, you just look at it. Like, God, how many people do we know who defaced websites when they were kids?
Exactly, right, exactly. And I mean, it's not like you're, you know, a criminal mastermind when you're posting it on Zone H, you know, just so you can move up the leaderboard.
I still can't believe Zone H is still around, to be honest.
I know, it's amazing.
It is. Now, more headlines from 2020, the year 2020 AD. This is a headline from 2020 AD. That is the year 2020 AD. The headline reads, FBI says credential stuffing attacks are behind some recent bank hacks.
Oh my God, you mean hackers would type the passwords into the login box and then log in? Wow.
They might even automate that process.
Ooh. Oh dear. Yeah, I mean, you know, it does illustrate the old dumb ways if they get the job done, you know, but you would hope that a bank would be better than that. Bank grade security ought to be better than that. They ought to have multi-factor auth, but yeah, apparently not in some places.
Yeah, I just wanted to include that one because old stuff is a bit of a theme this week. It's been a bit of a theme all 2020 there. Now, you remember a while ago we spoke about how Magento 1X going end of life was going to, like, be a problem at some point. Guess what? Magentageddon is here.
Yep, if you're running Ancient Magento, you are, in fact, going to have a bad time. It does look like there's some bugs being sold on the underground, which presumably are never going to get patched, given that it's end of life. Obviously the hackers are very aware that there are credit cards there to be taken, and they're getting taken.
Yeah, I think the interesting thing is here, like around the time, and Catalan points this out in his write-up, Magento 1X, as soon as they announced they were going to end of life it, Magento 1X bugs just stopped being disclosed publicly, right? So everybody has yes. built up like a massive stockpile of Magento 1X bugs, and now they're just going to use them. And apparently like the attacks we're seeing now are the biggest ever, and it makes sense because there's still so much Magento 1X out there.
Yeah, I mean, the numbers of deployed installs, you know, is gradually going down, which is good. But, I mean, a couple of 100,000 down to 100,000, that's still 100,000, web stores that are going to get hacked, probably already hacked. They're probably fighting over it, you know, all the people who are in there, you know, trying to maintain control. So, yep.
Now a story about missed opportunities. Equinix, Adam.
Oh, dear. So, yeah, Equinix, the very large data center and kind of backbone network operator, they got themselves ransomware. It looks like at least some of the Australian operations, and we don't know how much else around the world has been owned. But, yeah, someone got in there, ransomware it up. There's some screenshots and things, ransom notes floating around that do suggest that it's very real. But, I mean, owning a company like that that provides data centers for so many other people, I mean, can you imagine how much more ransomwaring you could do, with that level of access, when you've got control over the data center environment? So very much feels like a missed opportunity for the ransomware gang in question.
Man, my
could have been so good.
One of my contributions to yesterday's newsletter. Also, everyone subscribe to the Seriously Risky Business newsletter. But one of my contributions was to edit this line. Customer equipment hosted in Equinix data centers is unaffected. So my edit was customer equipment hosted in Equinix data centers is so far unaffected. That was that was my edit because I just couldn't quite believe it.
Yeah, I mean, you would think, right, if you really wanted to milk, your intrusion for all it's worth, then, you would go that way. But then, hey, I guess ransomware crews are onto an operation that's probably pretty slick and polished and smooth. And, you get in, you hit the file server, you send the ransom mail, next target.
Yeah, but this is like those kids who own Twitter, like who had access to all these high-profile yeah. Twitter accounts and just did dumb stuff. Like, it's the same thing. It's like, come on, hack properly, will you? Come on!
Exactly. You can do better. You can do better. We are disappointed.
We are very disappointed in your lack of, criminal nous. Now, oh, man, like, Turns out Microsoft patched a pretty serious bug back in August, and I'm kind of surprised that no one twigged that there was something this good in that patch release because it was already there. The info was there's a CVSS 10. In this patch Tuesday. That was the August patch Tuesday. But, oh boy, was it a good one. Tell us about it.
Oh, this is a good bug. Researchers at a company called Secura have been looking into how Microsoft authentication works. And this one area of kind of authentication across the network between components that doesn't use the normal kind of RPC authentication mechanisms that you see on Windows for what turned out to be quite old legacy reasons. And this particular bug involves the net logon message. Computers need to be able to log on to the domain. In the old days, computer accounts weren't kind of like full-fledged members of the domain. So there was like a special handling for how authentication of the network logon message worked. Anyway, this researcher, Tom Tevoort, looked into this authentication process for the net logon message and found a crypto bug, like an honest to God, we used a dumb cryptographic mechanism, and as a result, we're able to, kind of bypass the encryption requirement. And the net result of this is that you can change the password of a machine account in the Windows domain to be empty without knowing any credentials, without having any domain account. So you can go from completely unauthed to I can change a computer account. And you can do this to a domain controller. And at that point, you can then make RPC calls to the domain controller, authenticate, and replicate the Active Directory out or do whatever else you would like to do, which essentially means visibility of the domain gets you domain admin.
Yeah.
Via this bug.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And, wow. People are like, wow, you could go from a user account to domain admin. It's like, no.
No.
You can go from owning the smart thermometer in the building to domain admin, like it's...
Oh boy. Yeah. I mean, this is just, it's a beautiful bug. And it goes back ages as well. You know, Microsoft, of course, did introduce some patches. They didn't completely fix it, but they've changed one of the prerequisites that needed to be met in terms of.
I wanted to talk to you about this, right? Because yes. there's in the end of their white paper, they sort of say, well, there's some legacy devices that still might be affected. I'm not entirely sure I know what they meant by that.
Yeah, so it's I'm also a little bit unclear as to exactly how far back this goes in the Windows environment. Like, this isn't a pretty old part of the protocol, so I do expect that it goes back to 2003. You know, things that are end of life that aren't going to get patches.
But I mean, I guess they've got problems already, you know?
Well, of course, but I mean, there are people who do have this kind of stuff lying around on their network, stuff that's old and out of date, you know, and it's not implausible. And of course, you know, the big money attack of going after the domain controller is what people are focusing on, but you can use this for other, you know, other computer accounts as well. So there may be, you know, you could use this as a stepping stone to get onto a domain where you don't have other credentials. So there may be some other options there where it makes sense to use this. But yeah, exactly, you know, where the fix that they deployed in August may break stuff and therefore might have been avoided, or where it's not ever going to be patched and where it applies is a little bit kind of wishy-washy. Obviously, Microsoft are trying to keep this one quiet, I think. You know, the depths of Windows authentication, especially when it's this kind of really old stuff, is a little bit murky. And obviously Microsoft, you know, weren't super incentivized to really clearly articulate what was going on in this bug when they originally patched it back in, well, they prevented it back in August. So yeah, I'm a little unclear as well. And I think, you know, there's a proof of concept out. I mean, the original research had a checking script, but didn't have an actual working exploit.
Yeah, but I mean, this is worth mentioning that there's a proof of concept for the Insta Domain Admin, even if you can just see the network. I mean, that seems like it's maybe worth mentioning. We might have led with that, you know?
yeah, well, exactly. Yeah, Dirk Jan published an update, published a script that works with Impact to be able to do this, and also handles the very important step that we should also make sure that everyone's aware of, that this does set the password to empty, which will break a bunch of things. And if you do it to a domain controller, the domain controller's local idea of what its password is and the domain's idea of what its password is are now out of sync, and things will break, like DNS will stop working, for example. So Dirk Jan's scripts provides the mechanism for you to put that back afterwards. Please remember, pen testers, to do that. Otherwise, Lordy knows what you're going to break.
You're going to get sued, basically.
maybe.
Man. Okay, moving on to some other research now. And someone's actually found a practical use for speculative execution trickery.
This is really interesting research. I love this. So some researchers from a number of universities in Europe were looking into using speculative execution to defeat ASLR. So the idea is that you would, you know, speculative execution, the processor will execute a bunch of branches ahead of where it thinks it's going to be and then store those results so that when you decide which branch you're going to take, it's got them all kind of cached and ready to go. So it executes things that it doesn't necessarily need to down branches that are never going to happen. And then the processor internally is responsible for, you know, making sure that that never affects the state of the system outside. And these researchers have the insight that you could use that to determine where a randomized object was. So reduce layout randomization puts things in locations you can't predict. And the idea is to have a piece of software that will branch towards all the possible locations or a bunch of possible locations where the randomized object might be that you're trying to find, let speculative execution take care of it without triggering any security controls, and then use that to de-ASLR things, which is really smart. I love it. It's great research. Now, in terms of practically using it in memory corruption exploits, you know, outside of a lab environment, I'm not 100% sure yet. Like, it's, you know, you'd have to actually really fiddle with it, I think, to get an idea of how viable that really is. But such a smart idea, and just, yeah, I love it. Great research.
And a bunch of Bluetooth research came out this week as well.
Yeah, there's two sets of Bluetooth research that have come out. One relates to, there's kind of two types of Bluetooth, right? There's low energy Bluetooth and there's regular Bluetooth. And there are some devices will have both for different contexts. And there is a mechanism for using one to derive key material to be used with the other so that you can make the pairing process, you know, really simple for people, and it can, you know, devices can, you know, interact in different Bluetooth protocols without having to rekey each of them. Anyway, this mechanism called cross-transport key derivation, there was a bug that was found in a number of the implementations where you can kind of overwrite key material. Anyway, net result of all of this is the ability to be able to take over a Bluetooth connection or re-key a Bluetooth connection without having gone through the pairing process. So given how many Bluetooth devices there are in the world, that's kind of important. And also difficult to patch, you know, because rolling out software updates to all the sorts of devices that use Bluetooth, you know, kind of difficult.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's sort of well established that Bluetooth is not something you should really use for critical applications, right? Like, I don't know too many people who work in sensitive environments who aren't using wired keyboards.
Yeah, well, exactly, yeah. But I mean, you know, there's just a lot of Bluetooth in a lot of places, you know, whether people realize it's security critical or not.
Yeah.
The other set of Bluetooth attacks relates to the reconnection process in low-energy Bluetooth, which I guess is just an area that people haven't really looked at in a lot of detail. And the standard's a little bit wishy-washy about how authentication during reconnection as opposed to initial pairing is meant to work. And some researchers found bugs in a couple of the common implementations, the Linux one and the Android one in particular, may let you kind of take over in that reconnection scenario rather than during the pairing time.
Now, moving on, we've got some interesting work from MITRE here, which is they're helping people to essentially emulate FIN6 activity. So it looks like they're really getting behind attack simulation, which has been kind of something for fancy companies to do, but it looks like it's moving more towards the mainstream.
Yeah, this is really cool work. And, you know, we've kind of seen the gradual build up towards this, you know, with MITRE's work on taxonomies and, you know, the attack framework and all that kind of thing. And, you know, it's a thing that red teamers and other people who do that kind of attack simulation stuff, you know, have always tried to be able to do, right? To say, hey, we'll operate in the style of a particular attacker or a particular adversary. But having some real you know, kind of framework around that in attack was really useful. But now we're getting these kinds of, you know, centrally developed playbooks that describe, hey, if you want to operate like FIN6, here are the specific techniques they use for recon, for lateral movement, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, developing that kind of intelligence really does make sense to do as a thing where lots of people can contribute to it and then use the outcome. And it's really nice to see this happening in the open rather than in the kind of, you know, labs of individual, you know, threat research companies and that kind of thing. So this is really cool. And you know, they've released, there was a couple of other examples of this work that they were doing earlier on, you know, the last few years. But this does look like a, you know, a project that's now got a bit of momentum. And yeah, the details they've got around how to act like FIN6, yeah, is really well worth a read for anyone who's in this particular game.
Yeah, I just find it interesting, right? Because I think MITRE has been doing really good work with the attack, you know, attack matrix and all of that. And then this sort of closes the loop on that, right? It's research you can actually use. So that's very cool. Link in the show notes. We're just going to whip through a few items quickly now. ZDNet reports that porn sites were dropping malware on people. I mean, I know I'm shocked, right? But apparently malware crews were like running ads on porn sites that were malicious ads. And like, I mean, this
to exploit Internet Explorer and Flash. Like, yeah. This is such a, you know, 2013 story. So it's kind of nice. See people kicking it old school.
Yeah. I think they were having party time just before various things get end of life. Right. And they were just did it. I'm guessing because the CPMs were the cheapest on porn sites. So, you know, not a huge surprise there. Then we got this story, another one from Catalan about a Bitcoin bug. It was a bug in Bitcoin Core, and it looks like it was a DOS bug, but a pretty serious one. And the guy who found the bug actually sat on it for 2 years because they reckon it just would have caused chaos if they hadn't. And I got to say, I agree with that assessment.
Yeah, this was a bug that would allow, like, I think, uncontrolled like memory use on Bitcoin nodes. So yeah, the idea that you could just take out all of the Bitcoin mining operations, that could probably make some real money out of that. Plus, of course, yeah, the denial of service aspect of just being able to take out the entire Bitcoin network, which frankly would have been a good thing to do.
I didn't even think of that if you could take down enough nodes, you could actually just take over the blockchain, couldn't you? All of the monies to you.
I mean, that does seem like a thing that would be viable. I don't know the exact specifics. Like, I don't know how long you'd be able to suppress the other nodes for, but yeah.
Need to do it for that long. And then a Bond villain is born. Basically at that point, right? We got another stat here, which says it's another Catalan headline. Vast majority of cyber attacks on cloud servers aim to mine cryptocurrency. Can't say that's terribly surprising. Like, by volume, that makes sense, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it goes to show that the, you know, the bulk low-end attacks are the ones that are not particularly interesting. And yeah, that's, I guess, cryptocurrency is a very easy way to monetize the server you've got. And the, you know, the interesting ones tend to be the more targeted, more specific things rather than just financial. But yeah, you know, I guess it goes to show that people are making money whatever way works.
A Slovakian cryptocurrency exchange named Etherbase is currently chasing a whole bunch of stolen money around the blockchain, Adam.
Yeah, they got their hot wallets owned and a bunch of cryptocurrencies nicked. There's no particular, you know, details about how they got owned, but hey, it doesn't really matter. It's just a, you know, another exchange having their money
$5.4 million, but they're telling users, look, we have suspended our platform, but don't worry, we can totally cover this. And it's like, well, why have you suspended your platform then? They probably can, but I don't know, man. I just would feel a bit nervous. What else have we got here? Oh, now this is our skateboarding dog. It's a skateboarding Chinese ambassador, basically. China's ambassador to the United Kingdom had a pretty embarrassing day.
Yes, apparently he liked a pornographic video on Twitter. But that's okay because he didn't do it. Hackers did it. They logged into his account and liked pornographic material and some other, you know, some other tweets that the Chinese government's kind of embarrassed about. So, but yeah, hackers did it. Totally wasn't, you know, drunk ambassador.
Yeah, so, I mean, a few of the tweets liked were critical of Beijing's treatment of Uyghur Muslims, right? Which, you know, you would think is probably not the sort of thing that a Chinese ambassador is going to be clicking the old heart button on.
Probably not, but hey, maybe he missed. Like, maybe, you know, he slipped with his phone. And, you know, everyone's done that. Like, you're browsing Twitter, you slip, you accidentally hit heart. It happens.
Accidentally was looking at some foot fetish porn as well when his finger accidentally slipped. Yeah, interesting. Interesting theory there, guy. It is funny. There were a couple of Australian. There was a whole series of, like, politicians in Australia who just happened to like a bunch of porn tweets. And to the point where it almost felt like it could have been a hacker going around, like, because there were so many of them that it was like some
safety
weird
in numbers,
PsyOps campaign. But one of them in particular, the guy's like, I'm referring to this to the federal police, and then just, you know, nobody heard about anything about it ever again. So, but too, yeah, you got to keep in mind too, sometimes it's staffers for these people who make these mistakes. You know, they get confused about which account they're actually logged into.
Well, I mean, it happens. It could totally happen.
Now we're going to drop links to two long reads this week. The first one is a story about someone whose job it was at Facebook to hunt coordinated, you know, inauthentic behavior. They sort of rage quit. Well, they were rage fired kind of thing, like once you read the story, but they turned down a pretty tasty severance package in order to be able to talk about their experience inside Facebook. It's worth a read because it seems like a fairly unvarnished look at what things are actually like in there in terms of, hey, no one really knows what they're doing, and they're pretty responsive to PR. The strategy's not all there, but people mean well. I mean, that was kind of my read on it. What was yours?
Yeah, I thought it was really interesting contrasting this with the story we had a few years ago about the actual content moderators that were just doing like regular Facebook moderation, you know, versus this. And, the, you know, well, there's some certainly some parallels in terms of the impact on the individuals in having to deal with this. But so much, you know, I mean, it's one thing to see, you know, people being jerks to each other on an individual level. But when you're, you know, feeling responsible for, you know, how the democratic process is playing out in another country where you have no local context, you don't really understand the language, and, you know, that level of responsibility just seems to have really weighed upon the person who wrote this particular thing. And so that was an interesting angle. And yeah, also the, like, just how confusing it is. I mean, you and I cover this stuff, you know, I guess professionally, right? And even how many times do we end up going, well, I don't know what's going on. Like, who yeah. even can tell? And when you're, and that's when we have the benefit of, you know, the reporting and a little bit of hindsight when we're covering it as a news of a thing that's already happened versus trying to parse what's going on, you know, in real time and make, you know, really important decisions with very little guidance.
Yeah, I mean, there's stories in here about how they spotted, like, you know, inauthentic behavior coming from political campaigns and whatnot, and they'd squash it and go, yeah, job well done, and they'd be back in 2 weeks, you know. So, yeah, Sophie Zhang, who is a former Facebook data scientist, is the source here. The story was written by Craig Silverman, Ryan Mack, and Pranav Dixit at BuzzFeed. Link in the show notes. That's a good one. Now, ages ago, you and I spoke about Mango PDF. about Alex.
Old mate Mango.
Old mate Mango, who'd written a story called Operation Luigi, which was about, you know, basically taking over someone's email account. It was very, very well written and very, very funny. Just looking at that whole phishing thing, I guess. He's done another huge write-up on his blog. I'll just tell you the title, which is When You Browse Instagram and Find Former Australian Prime Minister Tony Abbott's Passport Number. He's done a great write-up of the whole rabbit warren he went down with that, which includes him actually having a telephone conversation with former Australian Prime Minister Tony Abbott. So well done, Alex. I see that one is actually kind of blowing up on the Twitters at the moment. So, yeah, link in this week's show notes. Do go have a read of that. Adam, that's actually it for the week's news. We've got a couple of weeks off, so I guess I'll chat to you again in 3 weeks, pal.
Yeah, we'll see what kind of madness happens while we're on break. And yeah, we can pull it all apart in a few weeks and I'll talk to you then.
That was Adam Boileau there with a check of the week's security news headlines. It is time for this week's sponsor interview now, and this week's show is brought to you by Senatas. Senatas is an Australian company that makes a bunch of interesting stuff. Their specialty, though, is Layer 2 encryptors. Their products are distributed by Thales, and yeah, if you need a 100 gigabit per second full line rate Layer 2 encryptor, give them a bell. They also have a major shareholding in Vitero, which is content disarm and reconstruction tech. That is a really good replacement for sandbox-based anti-malware mail gateways, by the way. So if you're looking to pull out an old sandbox anti-malware thing and replace it with something, this is a good option. CDR is, you know, where they pull documents apart and then reassemble them into a safe format. Don't worry though, this isn't dumb. It doesn't squash everything into a PDF, which was like the first generation of that sort of technology. Incredibly lame. But yeah, that might be one to take a look at. Senatas also has a product called SureDrop, which is a collaboration and file sharing platform, kind of like Dropbox, but you can plug it into your O365 and whatnot as well. They've got some fancy key management tech as part of that because, well, you know, they're an encryption company at their core. But given the nature of the stuff they build, they do a lot of business with government, particularly the Australian government. So instead of partnering with the usual suspects when it came to cloudifying SureDrop, Senatas went with a local partner, AU Cloud. As you'll hear, organisations are getting increasingly twitchy about data sovereignty these days, which means there's room for truly local providers. Peter Farrelly is the CISO of AU Cloud, and he joined us to talk through some changes to the Australian government guidance vis-a-vis cloud computing. Now, as I said at the intro, if you're an Australian govy, this interview is for you. Julian jumps in at one point, but Peter starts off here by telling us why the ACSC here in Australia has released this new guidance, the Cloud Assessment and Authorisation Framework. Here's Peter.
So I guess the main motivation for the new Cloud Assessment and Authorisation Framework was largely driven through a cloud consultative forum that AU Cloud was invited to be part of. That forum was convened and that included representatives from government, industry, the IRAP community or the assessor community for federal government, with a goal of sort of co-designing a new cloud security guidance package. That was the cloud forum or consultative forum. That was an output of an independent review that they did, and that was led by Professor Brendan Sargent. And there was sort of, you know, broad agreement from all parties, both industry, global providers, local providers, that the process was actually really well run. And it sort of allowed all parties to have a voice. There was things that we agreed on, there's things we disagreed on, you know, but it was overall, it was really, really well run. So ultimately, I think that outcome has been a good one.
Let's talk about what that outcome is. Like, what changed? Because there already was a way for Australian government departments, for example, to determine, you know, whether or not a cloud service was appropriate. Like, how has that changed?
Yeah, so I think previously under that sort of old arrangement or the CCSL as it was at that time, obviously with ASD sort of acting as the accreditation authority, I think what you saw was a lot of people were going, oh, well, you know, that's been added to this list and that means we can use it. But I think that ultimately meant for a government agency, there's a lot of them were sort of then remiss in the sort of understanding or assessment and acceptance of risk of using cloud for their own agency. It was kind of like, oh, well, we'll just leverage the fact that ASD says it's okay and we'll move on.
So ASD says Amazon's fine. So now we're going to go and tick a whole bunch of boxes and make it a non-default thing and like kind of screw it up. And that's fine because it's on the ASD list.
Yeah. But I think ultimately, you know, those agencies are still responsible for the data that's in their care. You know, ASD might have added somebody to the CCSL, and obviously that had gone through a process. But, you know, in the case of some of those global providers as well, their acceptance onto that list also came with a raft of additional recommendations or additional controls that an organization was meant to implement as part of using those services. So there was, you know, a large degree of, I think, some agencies being sort of remiss in their own responsibilities. And I think ultimately this new cloud authorization and assessment framework, I think it makes that really key point that agencies are responsible for assessing, accepting, and mitigating risks for their own specific use of cloud services. Now, that's actually not new. That was actually always in the previous guidance. But I think having a list of the CCSL and the way it was presented, it allowed people to sort of hide behind that.
Yeah, so, pretend they didn't realise that they had to go through this exercise of actually figuring it all out. Now, ASD and ACSC are sort of known for issuing pretty good guidance, right, that people outside of Australia will pay attention to. Can you walk us through what the basic gist of the guidance is?
Yeah, so they've obviously introduced a new process. It sort of builds on the previous process that drew on the IRAP community or the assessor community. But basically, it sort of frames it in sort of different phases. And those phases are there's a sort of cloud service provider, which obviously AU Cloud would fall into. And as part of that, you know, we need to go through a process where we assessed against the ISM. But one of the key things that they've sort of introduced into this whole process as well is this concept of security fundamentals. And that security fundamentals is actually largely driven around a new definition that they've introduced for data. So they've identified a number of types of data. And as part of that security fundamentals, they're asking cloud service providers to obviously state where that data is stored, how that data treated, and ultimately how it's accessed as well. So, you know, obviously in the example of some of those global MSPs, you know, you might say that your data, it's stored within Australia, but that doesn't alleviate the fact that it might be accessed by external parts of your business, or that, you know, there's a derived data or there's analytics that are all fed up into or out of Australia and used for a variety of different reasons as well. So
a lot of this is about data sovereignty, isn't it? And like, why is this kicking up now? Because like most of the providers, I'd imagine, sort of US-based, a lot of those providers do have a presence here. They've got big data centers, right? So if you want AWS just in Australia, you can have AWS in Australia. So why is the sovereignty then such a big issue? Is it because people, you know, because I can't imagine Australian government departments are like signing up to put their stuff on Alibaba Cloud, right? Like, what's the problem they're trying to solve here?
I actually don't think this is new. So for, I think, a lot of people who have been following the government announcements for a number of years now, there has always been a strategic shift to sovereignty, and it's been happening for a number of years. And I think it sort of really started to drive home, I think it was probably around March 2019, that they actually, government came out with their own sort of hosting strategy. And within that strategy, they actually defined two types of data center providers that their own framework would draw upon. One was certified sovereign. And that was basically, you know, a data center or provider that represented the highest level of assurance and is only available to providers that would allow the government to specify ownership and control conditions. And then there was a certified assured, which sort of for data center providers, it would safeguard against a number of risks of ownership or change of ownership through financial penalties, incentives, those sorts of things. But basically, it was sort of ultimately looking to minimize sort of the risk and cost to government if a data center provider was to change that profile. And then there's obviously all the other data centers that fall outside of that as well. So, you know, just regular data center providers that obviously don't have the focus on sovereignty and ultimately data protection that the government seeks to achieve. So I
got to ask, and I'm not actually going to ask you this question. It's a question about you, but I'm not going to ask you because Julian Fay is also on this call. Julian Fay of Senatess, they've partnered with AU Cloud to run their SureDrop service on it. Julian, I'm curious why you've partnered with AU Cloud. You know, why would you pick this local provider, which, you know, in comparison to something like Amazon, is a minnow, right? What's the advantage that you get by going with a sort of smaller company?
What we've really found over the last year is that the question of sovereignty, as Peter's mentioned earlier, has really started to come up in our conversations with those CISOs and these CIOs. Because even though SureDrop is an end-to-end encrypted solution where we're encrypting all the information that's stored in the service, we're providing client-side key management, time and again, we were getting asked, where is data ultimately being stored? But also, what is the risk of other information such as metadata, or even billing information being transmitted outside Australia? And that metadata can include things like names of virtual machines, obviously financial accounting information, network types used, etc. And it became pretty clear that this was becoming a growing concern for some of our customers. So we really wanted to partner with an organization that had a fully sovereign local capability and that could meet those customer needs. So we decided to partner with AUCloud. We thought it was a great story around an indigenous hosting capability. And frankly, from a technical perspective, they made it really easy for us. So it's a great IaaS, infrastructure as a service technology stack. They made it easy for our technical team to integrate, run the service on there. And we've been very happy that we've been able to partner with them and make this available to our customers. So, but those were the principal reasons.
I think a lot of Americans listening to this might be surprised that Australian organizations would consider metadata entering the United States, a risk to them, right? Like that would be surprising to some of them, don't you think?
Quite possibly, yeah. But I think now that kind of reflects the, a kind of global trend that we're seeing and the awareness that, there's much more than just the raw data at stake here. And there are bigger questions. No one really knows what happens when you put your information into a cloud infrastructure. You really essentially lose control of it. And even if you're encrypting data and keeping control of the encryption you see and fully managing it, there's a whole bunch of other information that goes as part of that service. It's the teams that access the information. It's the frequency of access. It's the size of the files, et cetera. And we all know that that's very powerful and that in the wrong hands that can be used for adversarial purposes to get attacks or to...
Don't the majors, though, don't they offer, fully localized services?
Yeah, no, they do. Obviously, a lot of them do. But ultimately, a lot of this new framework that's been developed, as Julian alluded to, it's not just about that raw data. It's about customer data. It's about monitoring data. It's about metadata. There's analytical data. So, there's a whole range of things that sort of come together. And then for a lot of those sort of global suppliers as well, not all those services are located in Australia. So, there is more than likely going to be some services that are consuming or are used by those global providers that are hosted offshore. Not all their services are within Australia.
Okay, Pete Farrelly, Julian Fay, thank you very much for joining us on the show. It's been an interesting chat. Thanks to you both.
Thanks, Scott. Thanks very much.
That was Peter Farrelly and Julian Fay there from AUCloud and Senatas, respectively. Big thanks to Senatas for being this week's sponsor and to AUCloud for making Peter available. And that is it for this week's show. A reminder, there will be no weekly shows for a couple of weeks. I'll be dropping a Soapbox edition next week, that one with Okta, and a special edition featuring former Australian Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull the week after that. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.